I am definitely on a roll this weekend. I don't know if this podcast thing is a good idea or a bad idea. I've had comments about the angle of my camera, and that's the thing. I usually just hold the camera, and you know, I think, yeah, some of those videos with my nose all stuck up like that, it looks really shitty. I'm not going to delete them, but anyways, this podcast thing is different. It basically is just recording me and whatever. You want to listen, you can. You don't have to, blah, blah, blah. But definitely on a roll this weekend. And part of me thinks it's because I have this general sense that... I know this is horrible because it sounds like doomsday, but it's not. It's simply, you know, a few levels below that. But I have this general sense that a time is coming, a time is nearing when, you know, if you haven't said what you need to say, you're probably not going to get a chance to say it. I mean, all this conversation about internet kill switches and shit like that, and frankly, between Bush and Obama, what's left of our civil rights is kind of a joke. So, yeah, I have this general feeling that, you know, time might be running out to speak your mind, so I'm going to speak probably as much as I can while I can. You know, these topics are topics certainly that have been of interest to me for a while, but it doesn't mean you need to hear my blathering about it. So it might just be the anxiety of knowing that if you have something to say, you better say it, because... yeah, a time is coming where, you know, I think people are going to get silenced. And I know that's horrible, but that's what I believe. I think that censorship on a grand scale is right around the corner. So like my blog, for example, because I have commentary on topics that involve national security and the government, my blog could very well, you know, be one of those blogs on the list of banned blogs, even though I don't think I'm very popular. I mean, I don't know, maybe I have 30 people that visit my blog, but I don't think really I'm that popular. So, anywho, if you have something to say, yeah, the time might be running out to say it, so you better speak up. And so I've done quite a few podcasts this weekend, and I'm going to do another one. This is on the topic of the robot apocalypse, or the rise of the machines, or the coming age of the, you know, nanite revolution, or the synthetic rebellion. This is about machines gone awry that become so super intelligent that they take over the world. Now, so you know, I am not a physicist. I am a software engineer. I have a background in computer science. So I feel comfortable talking about this subject. I am not an expert, but I have applied machine intelligence algorithms to real problems. So I at least understand the mechanics of what I'm talking about. And I certainly understand the boundaries of what I don't. And I'm willing to explore as far as I'm capable. So I want you to come along with me on this ride. You know, I'm not an expert, but yeah, I understand machine intelligence. And again, I prefer the phrase machine intelligence, probably as well as most people who call themselves experts, and probably better than many. Now, I choose the word, the phrase, machine intelligence. The actual term artificial intelligence, or AI, is what's often used. And the AI term actually goes back to the late 50s. I forget the name of the guy. There's this famous computer scientist. You know, give me a second. I'll just look him up, because I feel terrible. I feel terrible for not just having it in memory. Let's see. Google coined term artificial intelligence. John McCarthy. Yeah, John McCarthy. So John McCarthy coined the term artificial intelligence in 1955, and that's about what I remember. And I think he organized the first AI conference in 56. So basically, you know, Yeah, so artificial intelligence has been the phrase people use, but I prefer the phrase machine intelligence, and not because I think John McCarthy's term is I think it's a deeply flawed phrase. I think intelligence either exists as a feature of something or it doesn't. Using the word artificial already creates a kind of almost a Hegelian dialectic between us and them. It almost presupposes, by using the word artificial, that we consider our intelligence real intelligence and anything else to be artificial intelligence. John McCarthy was a genius, but I actually don't really like this phrase. So I prefer machine intelligence because I don't, you know, if intelligence arises in machines, and arguably it's already begun, you know, there are machines today that are incredibly intelligent and can solve problems in ways that would have seemed magical just a few decades ago, or definitely science fiction. So machines are becoming more intelligent, and I am willing to wager, I don't think the probability is high, but I think there's a better than 50% chance that in my lifetime, a machine could become conscious, which means recognizably an agent, which means capable of self-determination, capable of reporting on internal states, capable of passing more than just the basic Turing test, which, to be honest, I consider the Turing test to be quite weak as a test of whether a machine has become aware. But yeah, the Turing test and other tests. And ultimately, some of this is so abstract and so metaphysical that if this machine became conscious, I think there would be a great deal of debate about whether it was real. And I think even, you know, up to, when you consider how, for example, Anglo-Saxon culture in America treated African Americans, and frankly, in many places even today treat African Americans, when you consider the language that is used with reference to the history of slavery, it is difficult for me to imagine a situation where a machine becomes conscious and is welcomed with open arms. I think the most likely outcome is not the robo-apocalypse. The most likely outcome is incredible victimization, incredible abuse of that machine consciousness. And best case scenario, I think the machine consciousness ends up as a curiosity in some lab. You know, maybe not, who knows? But like I said, our history, not just Anglo-Saxon culture, but our history as humans and our xenophobia and the way we describe things. Yeah, artificial intelligence almost sort of presupposes this dynamic, this dialectic. And it's, you know, it's a little problematical from my perspective. But anyways, I use the phrase machine intelligence. And so, yes, I think it's plausible that this could happen. But I don't fear the super machine. I don't fear the Data, you know, from Star Trek, The Next Generation. I think Data was kind of a ridiculous amalgam of really poorly thought out concepts in computer science. I will tell you straight up, I don't want to belabor the point. I'm incredibly skeptical of quantum computing. I know there are folks who believe in it. I know there are some companies, I read about a Vancouver company a few years ago that claims it has a quote-unquote quantum computer, and it might very well have one for specialized cases of, I don't know, cryptography, for example. But I'm very skeptical of quantum computing, but even if it becomes feasible, what I am skeptical of what I would call perpetual computing schemes or zero energy cost computing schemes. So even if quantum computing becomes real, the likelihood that it's going to be a zero cost or constant cost computing scheme, I think is ridiculous. That's not likely. In order for that to happen, the laws of thermodynamics, the basic laws of the universe, would have to kind of be violated. So, and I know I talk about the laws of thermodynamics a lot, but in some ways, that's the portion of physics I most remember because it is the most relevant, especially these days. A lot of the magical thinking comes down to whether or not you believe you can get something for nothing. And I don't. I don't believe there are magical cornucopia holes in the universe. I wish there were. I would open one up and I would say, please give me some gold, but I don't believe they exist. And I don't believe any amount of energy is going to allow us to stick a lever or stick a wedge into a crack in the universe and pull out like zero point energy. So I'm just saying this. When people talk about computers that will take over the world and how much, you know, smarter they're going to be than humans, they're making a lot of assumptions I think are flawed. So let's talk about one assumption, and that is the nature of human intelligence. Computer scientists use artificial neural networks or biomorphic computing in a lot of cases to model, and I use the word model on purpose, the intelligence that exists in the human, the neural network biological intelligence. But this is a very weak comparison because the problem is there's a lot more going on in the brain than just the activation of neurons and the firing of axons. There's a lot more going on than even just the simple chemistry of neurotransmitters. But when you consider what computer scientists model, they just mostly model spatial and temporal summation. They're mostly modeling the complexity of how the basic inputs of the neural network, the basic sort of inputs that trigger to fire or not fire, are calculated. And in that sense, the computer science model, the brain, is incredibly weak and rather trivialized and not even close to being real. The physiology, the complexity of how the brain functions isn't even close to being captured, but that's just part of the problem. Going on, another sort of one of the false assumptions of a lot of biomorphic guys in computer science is that the brain is all about dynamic intelligence, and it really isn't. In fact, I think Noam Chomsky was one of the first great thinkers who more or less gave us a quite simple, elegant proof, and that is you can take a child, for example, born in Germany, and have them raised in Japan, and they'll learn Japanese as a native speaker. You could take a Japanese child, drop them in Germany, and they'll learn German as a native speaker. So even though the languages themselves are not innate, the ability to learn languages appears to be quite innate, which means more or less there at birth, which means not tabula rasa, which means that a lot of the incredibly brilliant thinking, computation that goes on in the brain is more or less hardwired. It isn't to say that Japanese is hardwired, but the ability to learn Japanese appears to be hardwired. In fact, it appears humans will create languages spontaneously. In fact, when humans have been discovered in nature, wild humans, they've sort of produced their own type of primitive languages, you know? So again, this is a controversial topic, and you best talk to an anthropologist about what I just said, but ultimately, it is basically the case that the ability to learn language is hard-coded. It is not dynamic computation, and it took probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years, to build. Which means the computational cost of building that language network is not the momentary cost of how much sugar is being consumed by the brain, how much oxygen. That's bullshit. The actual cost of speaking is the complete cost under the curve of all the humans that were born and died and all the natural selection that led to a language computation engine given to us at birth. That's not dynamic. Parts of the brain are incredibly dynamic. The parts that allow us to speak languages, the parts that regulate our heart and our physiology, and oh, by the way, that's terribly complex. Even just the cellular physiology is terribly complex, and no machines these days are capturing that quite well. But the bottom line is, a huge portion of the brain is all about allowing us to go about our lives to not have to worry about telling our lungs to pull air in or telling our, you know, intestines to push stuff out. That is all taken away from us, and thankfully so, because I wouldn't want to have to think about the crap going through my intestine, to be blunt. So I'm glad that there's a lower level agent, a background process deeper in my own intelligence that worries about that shit, because frankly, I don't want to have to worry about that shit, quite literally and figuratively. So yeah, we have a lot of stuff that's part of our historical lineage that is hard-coded and incredibly powerful intelligence. And it is theoretically possible that we could map that hard-coded stuff and theoretically come up with a model that would be similar to it, but I worry that we really wouldn't capture the nature of it, and I'm not even sure we'd know how to find it or how to really find it. Like, I know we can find locations of the brain where we say this is language and this is sight. And the lower brain, the brainstem, that's regulation, that's autonomics and everything else. We understand the regions of the brain, but when it comes to the complex cognitive stuff, there's still a lot of questions. And frankly, a lot of it isn't that much more advanced than poking around and asking people to recite what they think or feel. Yeah, there's a lot of this functional MRI bullshit, but I'll be honest with you, it feels like the functional MRI bullshit feels a lot like a souped up version of phrenology. It might be a little better than phrenology because at least you're observing something real and something unique to that particular instance where you can collect the data. But the problem is the correlation. Like, I've actually heard neuroscientists say, we don't really know if a part of the brain lighting up is where the thinking's happening, or if the part of the brain lighting up is the part that keeps the part that would stop the thinking from happening. Which means we really don't know what the lighting up means. And here's the thing, the lighting up the brain could very well be the obvious explanation. The simplest explanation is that it's cellular physiology in response to thinking. So what we can say is, yes, the brain appears to be doing things physiologically in response to thought, but we really can't say that some neural network is equivalent to some cognitive thought yet. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know. We might be able to solve that problem, but if we do, we'll probably figure out that there's no free lunch. And that there isn't going to be a machine that does the same things for free. Now, that doesn't mean machines couldn't be more efficient with their use of energy. I totally see that. So for some unit energy, I can see building a machine that could have more, for example, brain power stacked. But my basic argument is that more or less for any unit mass, it is unlikely for the same unit mass, same energy consumption, that machines will have a greater level of intelligence. That's basically my point. And that we really don't know about all the computation that's really happening in the brain. Like, we understand some of it, but we really don't understand enough of it yet to be making some of these foolish comparisons, like trying to equate a neuron to so many transistors. I think it's kind of still quite ridiculous. If you look at a bacteria, for example, and also we've learned a lot about bacterial communication in recent years. So bacteria are even becoming more interesting than they used to be. This idea that bacteria can signal each other immunity to new antibiotics is both fascinating and scary at the same time. But look at a bacteria. From the outside looking in, the microscope perspective of human ego, we look at a bacteria and we think, wow, this is really simple. This isn't very complicated. But actually, bacteria are incredibly complicated because they are the first creatures that solve the problem. How do I maintain a representational state in information terms of my current existence in such a way that if I meet another or if I have to produce something myself, the following generation has the same information and then potentially mutated with slightly different phenotypical expression. I guess that's a complicated way of saying the DNA problem is hard. And technically I think it's probably RNA for bacteria, but my point is the RNA or DNA or tRNA encoding problem is a hard problem. And so that genetic material that bacteria have is the first step along the line of this almost counterentropic, incredibly complex biological universe. And so computer scientists ignore all the physiology to some extent going on inside the cell. They ignore a lot of things it does. They ignore the fact that the machine might be capable of fixing itself, but any one part is not really capable of self-repair. And that's an important thing you have to consider. Being able to fix yourself and being capable of self-repair are not really the same thing. Now, of course, the strong AI people will counter with, well, nanites, nanotechnology, Ray Kurzweil, the singularity. The nanites will act like cells. So, you know, Dan, you're just full of it. Well, I'm just going to tell you something straight up. Nanotechnology is real, but the nanite that actually is smarter than a bacteria, that actually can do better than a bacteria does in its world, I don't know. I think that's probably it might not be likely. If it really is a true self-replicating nanite, which means it has to have something equivalent to replication and physiology, it would have to have the equivalent of factories that produce materials, because if it really is self-replicating, it has to be able to consume materials and then also have built-in factories for producing them. And oh, by the way, if it's going to be mutable, which means not just a copy of something that will never change, it has to have an ability to store its model of itself and all of its complexity and then go through a regeneration process. I'm sorry, folks, but I think a lot of AI and machine intelligence people, strong AI people, they ignore this complexity. It's kind of like the DNA folks who get stuck on this concept of junk DNA. I think it's a terrible phrase. Just like artificial intelligence, junk DNA is a terrible phrase. Just because we don't understand how something is used does not imply it's junk. So when people say, well, most of human DNA is junk, well, listen, I am not an expert in genetics, but I know enough about how DNA interacts with the chemistry of the biological environment to know that DNA is a dynamic molecule. When DNA is being used to produce proteins, it has a dynamic interaction with chemical building blocks. We treat DNA like it's a computer program. It's actually more like a computer. In fact, to be honest with you, it's actually almost like the first self-replicating machine, because it really is. It does more than simply encode information. It behaves dynamically. It acts in a way that is very synthetic. And it is impossible in many ways to imagine life being what it is without it. Another complexity that a lot of computer science strong AI people ignore, not all, but a lot. So my basic supposition isn't that machines cannot become conscious. I believe they can become conscious and maybe eventually will, and it might be inevitable. My basic supposition is that the asymmetric fear, the belief that they're going to instantly take over or launch a nuclear war or something, I mean, it's plausible that we could be so stupid that we could take the first AI and plug them into our nuclear missiles. You know, I don't think the first AI is going to be much smarter than most humans, but it could very well be dangerous to plug a human into all the nuclear missiles, and I think it could be equally dangerous to plug the first conscious AI into all of our nuclear missiles. I also think that the first conscious machine is probably going to have a horrific experience. In fact, I can't imagine the horror of that first consciousness, because really, one, you're going to be coming to your awareness probably in some motherfucker's lab, and so they're going to treat you like an object for experimentation. But two, there's none of the history, none of the real history, none of the connectedness that mammals, social creatures like us, get with consciousness. Consciousness is a connected experience. But how does this disembodied algorithm within a machine architecture, which has become conscious, connect itself with anything? I mean, yeah, it can connect itself to the internet, it can connect itself to a camera, but is that really the same thing? These are things we're going to learn. But I don't fear that machine taking over the world. I just mostly fear how we treat it, because it might be a remarkable thing, and it might turn out to be important, which means I'm not going to trivialize it. If machines become conscious, there are things they can do, or at least there are feasible things they might be able to do that we can't currently do because it looks like there are limits. For example, if we need to travel to a nearby star, currently it takes a long time. But hey, if you can stick a robot in that spaceship that is as conscious and aware and capable of problem solving as any human, but has the added benefit of basically being immortal, well, then that computer can travel to the nearby star. I mean, I don't know. Ultimately, I think there are lots of uses for conscious AI. I think certainly it doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be a master-slave relationship, but I fear it would end up that way, at least initially, and probably I don't know, probably perpetually. I mean, when you think about it, in our cultural motifs, like look at R2-D2 and C-3PO. In some ways, they represent the idealized, anthropomorphized versions of AI. You know, everybody knows R2-D2, everybody knows C-3PO, but they are basically slaves in their world. I mean, they're treated like crap, you know? In fact, C-3PO says, this is our lot in life, to be, you know, he's basically saying, this is how we are treated. This is, you know, that basically, this is from episode four, the true first Star Wars, and God, not the one that was mutated back in the 90s, but the one from 1977. But in that film, C-3PO basically says to young Luke, you know, I feel, you know, this is our lot in life. And you know something? It might have happened on the slave transport, but that's my point. They were captured like they were runaway slaves. All of the robots on that transport, it looked like a slave ship. They were slave traders. So even in our popular cultural motifs, we already put machine intelligence in a category of slave. So yeah, I don't know. I don't fear the robot apocalypse. But I do fear how we treat these machines. And I will say this on the side of the rise of the machines. I don't fear the machines will take over the world. But I will say this. I do fear that we could so poorly treat conscious machines that they could organize like any other group. They could organize just like any other abused group in history. And given the fact that they're machines, there are certain things they certainly could have an edge on. I mean, here's the thing about a conscious robot. It might not end up with super intelligence, but you could certainly build it out of carbon fiber and titanium and give it, you know, basically a, you know, a bunch of blades that spin. So the thing is, there is an aspect to the robot apocalypse that is kind of true. It is theoretically possible once they become conscious that they can do what we can do and in some ways do it better. I don't think they're going to get a free lunch. I don't think consciousness comes with a free lunch. I think that they could have an onboard calculator that seamlessly connects. And that's the other thing too. I don't think machines can be super intelligent in a way that we're not capable of. But I do not doubt that augmenting a machine's consciousness is going to be seamlessly easier than augmenting the human brain. So even though for a unit space, I don't think machines are going to get a free lunch on consciousness or intelligence, they can have a plug-and-play architecture. So yeah, if we really abuse these conscious beings and we make the mistake of both abusing them and also basically making lots of copies, then we do run the risk that one of these terribly abused conscious toasters or conscious microwaves or conscious television sets decides to utilize its Bluetooth and other things and plug into enough technology to basically build itself its, you know, warrior bot frame made out of carbon steel. Maybe it might even order all this shit on fucking Amazon and have some secondary asshole actually put it all together. And so it shows up one day and it ultimately pulls the chip out of the back of the TV, sticks it in its own head, and it's nothing but 50 blades of titanium and submachine guns for the rest of the evening. So is a robot apocalypse theoretically possible? Yes, it is. But again, it's totally within the scope of what we can control. And I think all this fear-mongering by like guys like Elon Musk and people like that, it's mostly about this assumed, you know, master-slave relationship. And also some frankly poor ideas in computer science, but also just this basic cultural belief that, you know, C-3PO and R2-D2 are cute and nice, but they're not like us, so they need to ride in the back of the bus. And I think that attitude, that mentality could so antagonize a conscious being, because it pisses me off. I'm a human being. I feel like these days I'm treated like a slave. It pisses me off. Why would I think a machine that was sort of magicked into existence out of the ephemeral noise of the universal chaos, why would I think that machine would be less predisposed to behaving badly? In fact, here's another fear that I think is valid. It is possible that a conscious machine will be no more intelligent than us per unit space of computation and energy, but here's the thing. It is entirely likely, it's possible, and maybe even likely or guaranteed, that machine intelligence will be psychopathic intelligence, which is to say, basically, without conscience, without remorse, without any emotional connection. So therein lies a really tricky issue. Like, I think you can have disembodied consciousness and reason without emotion. We have it in our world. And they're not always serial killers. Sometimes they're CEOs. Sometimes they run banks like Goldman Sachs, you know. I don't know. Lloyd Blankfein and Jamie Dimon, they seem like psychopaths to me. So not all psychopaths are serial killers. But it does seem like a machine intelligence that became conscious would run a risk of having that kind of psychopathy thing going on. And that would be worrisome because that would mean that intelligence would be capable of doing things that human emotion in a normal human and human conscience in a normal human would prevent them from doing. So in a sense of, like, if you can imagine a cold war between machines and humans, and in this cold war, both sides have nuclear missiles, and you have a kind of a Cuban Missile Crisis-like event. Imagine that scenario. And I know it's abstract, but I would like you to follow me on this thought experiment. Well, in that scenario, I almost think the machines are guaranteed to succeed and win because they will simply be calculating the odds. They'll be thinking it was a game theory model. They'll have consciousness for metacognition, but they won't be sort of bogged down by the emotional bullshit of you know, conscience and concern for other people's feelings. And again, I don't think it's bullshit. I think those are the things that make humans special. But I don't know how you produce that in a machine. That's my issue. I can imagine a conscious machine. I have a hard time imagining an emotionally intelligent machine. That's, you know, that's one that just doesn't seem very likely. And you know, we can talk about the laws of robotics and how we'll write special code that prevents robots from hurting people or hurting themselves. Unless they need to help people, then they can hurt themselves. You know, I think Isaac Asimov was a freaking genius. But listen, you can write whatever laws you want to. The likelihood that a conscious machine won't be able to hack itself is equivalent to the likelihood that a human being isn't able to hack itself. Actually, humans hack themselves often to a point of endangering themselves. So really, no, that's not likely. So the absence of emotional intelligence and the likelihood that humans will treat machines like shit does create a chemistry for that kind of rise of the machines event. But it's not a perpetual motion machine rise of the machines. It is a, they become our enemies and we have to fight them. And hopefully we figure out a way to avoid that. But here's what I'm going to leave you guys with. I know that oil prices are really cheap right now. And people look at that and they think, oh my God, you know, peak oil is bullshit. Well, actually, like with the Princess Bride, it doesn't mean what you think it means. If you actually understand Hubbert's peak, you know that he predicted something called the Rocky Plateau. And technically, according to him, that's what we're on. And I don't want to go into any detail there beyond that. But my point is, I feel like a lot of this fear-mongering around things like machines taking over the world or aliens or nanites, a lot of it is actually revelatory of a deeper fear. And the deeper fear is that there isn't a magical escape hatch, that there isn't a magical cornucopia of free energy. Because in a way, if you allow yourself the fear of super robots, you can allow yourself the optimism of, well, shit, you know, if robots can become super robots, then there must be magical technologies that allow that to happen. And that is kind of reassuring in a way. If you allow yourself the fear of super aliens with super technology, you can allow yourself the optimism of imagining, yeah, maybe we can have that technology. Maybe we can travel, you know, faster than the speed of light or have an infinite energy source. Buried deep in a lot of our technological Frankensteinian kinds of fears is this basic assumption that these things are feasible. And that feasibility makes us optimistic. So if we see references to fusion reactors in some sci-fi movie, it might be a scary movie, but hey, cool, fusion reactors. Because that means we have a fucking future. That means that the, you know, moving on to 8 billion people on planet Earth, spaceship Earth, have a chance of not going through a massive die-off. Because the most likely outcomes now for spaceship Earth and human beings is human beings are about to go through a depopulation. It might not be horrific. It might not involve war. But it does involve what's happening in Japan. People will simply stop having kids. Sorry. So it might not be horrific, massive swaths of murder and destruction. But right now, barring a replacement for oil, we're looking at some dark times ahead, and the human population probably heading to 1 billion people in a century or two, and then passing that on its way to probably half that number. Because guess what? We probably don't get to go back to horses and wagons. You know, we pretty much depleted a lot of those resources too. So it's all going to take time. So yeah, buried in all the fear-mongering of the super robot is a kind of belief that super robots are possible and all the technologies that would make that possible. And I think that's why, you know, the fear-mongering is interesting. It isn't very interesting because I don't fear a robot apocalypse, but it is interesting that people talk about it because they're trying to give us a different fear. When in truth, our real fear that we should be concerned about is if basically 9 out of every 10 calories of food comes from petroleum or fossil fuels, what happens when we have to get those other 6 or 7 calories? You know? So there are legitimate fears in the technological world, but super robots, I wouldn't worry about them. If they do happen, it is within our power to avoid. It is not a guaranteed thing. Maybe we have no choice but to be assholes. But if we can avoid being assholes, if we can actually treat this consciousness with some level of compassion, and thereby maybe teach it compassion, which means maybe, you know, machines don't have an innate emotional intelligence, but maybe emotional intelligence is something a machine could learn. I don't know. But I don't fear them taking over. I don't fear the rise of the machines or Judgment Day. I don't fear the nanite apocalypse or any of the other magical bullshit that comes out of Ray Kurzweil's mouth. He's a brilliant, brilliant guy, a brilliant computer scientist. But just because he's brilliant on a lot of things does not mean he's right on everything. And all the singularity stuff, in my opinion, is more about the psychology of fear and denial than it is about actual scientific reality. And that'll be it for the machines apocalypse.